Today's Teisho will be on Case 50 in the Heikigan Roku in the Piyen Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 50 is entitled Umon's Particle After Particle Samadhi. Engo's Introduction. Transcending all ranks, rising above all expedients, spirit corresponding to spirit, words answering words, unless he has undergone the great emancipation and attained the great use of it, how could he rank with the Buddhas and be a faultless exponent of the teachings? Now tell me, who can be so direct and adaptable to all occasions and have the free command of transcendent words? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is particle after particle's samadhi? Umon said, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Secho's verse, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Even the most talkative can add nothing. The north and south stars do not change places. Heaven-touching waves arise on land. If you doubt, if you hesitate, though you are heir to millions, trouserless. Thank you so much for coming to sit this morning on this Saturday in December. We have been, many of us have been sitting together for a substantial amount of time. In fact, some of us have been sitting together for more than a decade, in fact, almost two decades. And some people are relatively new, that is, here less than a decade. Perhaps because we meditate regularly, you might have a cushion at home, in fact. You might have, you do this at home. Maybe you come here fairly often and you meditate here. And everybody sits down on a cushion, and everybody watches the breath, and so on. It's easy to take for granted what we're doing. It's easy to not fully appreciate how remarkable this thing called Zazen really is. Years ago, I was asked to demonstrate meditation for a bunch of elementary school children. And I sat down on the ground, and I had them all sit down on the ground. And I was talking to them about how meditation works, and we were watching our breath. And then I pulled my legs into full lotus, and they just exploded. That was so weird to them. I couldn't get them to focus ever again. That was the end of the lesson, right? If I had taken my head off and rolled it across the room, it couldn't have been more bizarre to them, you know? And they just couldn't get over it, right? It was just like that. After that, it was over. The lesson was over. They understood how remarkable Zazen really is in a certain way. But we might just take it for granted. You say, oh, okay, back to the cushion. You know, all right, back onto the cushion. But what we're doing, just the simple act of sitting down on the cushion, is quite important, really quite significant. You know, part of so many of our problems are caused by our culture, caused by the culture we live in today, which is really very confused. I don't know how confused. It's extremely confused. You know, I don't know how to describe it. But I was just reading an article the other day about how many young people, that is people under the age of 25, suffer from depression or other personality disorders. And it's really a staggering number and a very large percentage. And I don't think that's natural. I think that's our culture is doing this to people. And culture is everywhere, of course. It's in the way we eat. It's in the way we dress. But it has a lot of, I think it's done a lot of damage to our ability to appreciate and be aware and awake as we're going through our daily lives. You know, sitting on the cushion seems trivial. It seems like a gymnastics. We have a category now in our culture for meditation. So you sit down on the cushion, watch your breath. Yes, yes. But actually, it's really quite extraordinary what happens when we do zazen. The problem is we're sort of prisoners of a certain way of thinking about the body. Over Thanksgiving, I went to see my sister, and my sister has, I myself like to get a lot of exercise. I try to get exercise 3 or 4 times every week. And I love jogging, and I love to get exercise. I enjoy it very much. But my sister has been taking what's known as a spinning class. I don't know if you know about spinning. But it's a special kind of exercise class where everybody gets on these special bicycles. And it's really brutal. Even though I get a lot of exercise, when I went to my sister's spinning class, about halfway through I felt like bursting into tears. It's just ruthless, there's no chance to rest, So this trainer, her name is Dana, is like a spinning guru. She has all these people who will only train with Dana, and my sister is one of them. And they really think of her as like this amazing spinning master, And I went, and I thought, I can handle this. This is going to be easy. And honestly, halfway through, I just felt like crying. Dana, it just, you pedal very, very fast, and you increase the resistance on the machine, so it's like you're running uphill at top speed, and then you take some of the resistance off, but you have to go even faster, 140 RPMs minimum, And then you sometimes stand up on the bike for a little bit, and then you have to go halfway down, then you have to go all the way down, all the while you're pedaling. So, after the workout, we were driving home and I was talking to my sister in the kitchen. And she said, my sister is this wonderful person. She's a nurse practitioner and her specialization is oncology. And I love my sister very much. And she is a wonderful mother to her 2 sons. And she works very hard in her job. And she was just talking about how spinning is helping her to get thinner in her legs. She was saying, my thighs are getting a little heavy. My thighs are getting a little heavy, and I'm getting self-conscious about it, and I'm spinning so I can shrink my thighs. And it turns out that in fashion magazines, there's actually a term. Your thighs are not supposed to touch at the up where they touch your body. There's supposed to be a space there. And if there's no space, that's a problem. I didn't know that. I thought as long as your legs were still attached to your torso, it was okay. You're doing okay. But ideally there should be a space between your thighs. And if you don't have it, you've got to go do spinning until you feel like crying. And indeed, this woman, Dana, had no space between her thighs, or had a big space between her thighs, big space. So her thighs are very tight and just small. Now, this is actually so deeply ingrained in our culture. It's so deeply ingrained. For a long time, and even now, my wife will not look at certain magazines, certain women's magazines, like a Cosmopolitan or Harper's Bazaar or some others. She actually gets mad when she looks at these magazines. And I asked her, why? Why do you get mad at these magazines? And she said, because You know, my mother brought me up to be, you know, to try to imitate the models in these magazines. And, you know, I would spend all this time trying to look beautiful and, you know, and she said, I always felt that I wasn't physically attractive. She said, no matter what I did, you know, I would compare myself to these models in these magazines and I would feel so unattractive. You know, I was too skinny, too tall. You know, my ears were too big, whatever, you know, you're never quite right. And of course, it turns out that these models are often highly airbrushed and they're even photoshopped, you know, so that they have these impossibly small waists. Now, you know, all of this is part of the way we think about our bodies. You know, we think about our bodies as a project we have to work on, right? It's this project. And we have to, there's something wrong with our bodies, and we have to get them into the proper condition so that they can finally be beautiful or acceptable. And this is how we think. The body is like a problem. You know, there's not enough space between my thighs. This is a big problem. And I go out in public, perhaps, and I think, oh my God, I hope nobody notices, you know, my thighs, you know. We laugh at this, but it has a huge impact on the way we think about the body. And it's really culture through and through. You know, this is really culture telling us how to view our body, how to view our body. And we experience our body as though we're looking at it through somebody else's eyes. You know, you can take your shirt off and go into the bathroom and stand in front of the mirror and just sigh because, you know, maybe you don't look like a model, or you don't look, if you're a man, you don't look like Brad Pitt, you know. And, oh dear, you know, so many problems, you know. This is how we relate to our bodies a lot of the time in the modern world. You know, this is really sad. You know, imagine how it used to be, say, even just 1,000 years ago, really. You know, 1,000 years ago, by the way, Zen was already old. Buddhism had been around for a long time. Imagine if you lived in a world where, first of all, there were no mirrors in your home. That was common. Almost nobody owned mirrors. Only like aristocrats had mirrors, and they had little hand mirrors. So no mirrors. You know, basically no red book. You know, no magazines with emaciated models in them. You know. It would never occur to you that you didn't have enough space between your thighs. You know, your experience of your body would have been very different. It wouldn't have been centered on how you look compared to like an imaginary ideal. And I think maybe our relationship to the body could have been a little healthier and a little deeper. You know, the body is this wonderful, wonderful thing. And I don't mean because you're in good shape or you're in bad shape, but, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, the body is like the door into enlightenment. And it's also the door into the world. So everything we need to wake up is in this body, in this body. You know, we don't appreciate necessarily meditation because we have so many mistaken views about many things, and one of them is about the body itself. You know, so, you know, basically the body does all of these amazing things, and it has all of these amazing qualities that that our culture doesn't train us to appreciate at all. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, you know, we're really grounding ourselves in a very profound way, you know. You know, you sit down on the cushion, you straighten your spine, and the body, actually, you begin to relate to your body in a very different way. You know, you're present with your physical sensations. You're not watching yourself from a distance and judging. You're returning into your body, and you're being present with the body. And the body becomes this wonderful opportunity to experience the world. It's like the body is the door between yourself and the world. You know, so you sit down on the cushion, you straighten your spine, you start watching your breath, and maybe this morning, you know, when you begin to feel the air temperature, you know, you're feeling the air temperature on your face, and maybe you want to push that away. You know, you're feeling the sort of a little cool, a little more cool than you might be comfortable with. You want to push that away, and maybe you wish you had brought a blanket for your legs, so you're watching the breath, but there's that coolness or that uncomfortable, slightly coldness in the air, you know, and you go back to the breath, and there's the coldness again. You go back to the breath, and there's the coldness again. And there's a moment where you're thinking, this is really uncomfortable. You know, I really don't like this. But, you know, eventually, if you keep working on the breath, you begin to sort of become one with this coldness or this coolness. You suddenly realize this is okay, you know. And this sort of judging mind stops, and you're just present with the coolness, you know. And you're watching the breath, and you're becoming one with your breath, and your breath is taking you out, out, out. And, you know, if you just watch the breath for a little while, if you're not expecting anything, you can drop down into deep samadhi, deep samadhi. See, and samadhi isn't a gimmick. It's this deep consciousness that comes right out of accepting or embracing or being present with our bodies, you know. Last night, somebody who has been sitting a little bit had stopped sitting for about a month, and he came last night and he sat, and at the end of the evening I said, how was your sit? And he said, it was wonderful. He said, I came in, I sat down, and I was right in samadhi. I just settled right into it. You know, and when you're in this deep samadhi state, you know, you experience your own body in a different way. Parts of the body disappear. You know, it's as though you feel your face, and maybe you feel some of your legs, but other parts of your body are simply gone. You might feel like you're opening up, you know. And when you follow the breath out, you know, the breath is like taking you out into the world. It's like you follow that breath and it takes you out. It opens up into the world. You know, so when you're watching the breath, it's like you hollow out in a way, and you become open, you know. All of this is happening just by being present with the body, just by being present here and now with the body, you know. It doesn't always work this way. Sometimes, you know, there's your pain. You have pain in your legs, and that can be very distracting. But even with pain, you know, if you're present with your pain, you know, you enter deep samadhi. You enter deep samadhi. If the pain reaches a point where you can't stand it anymore, just adjust your legs. But if you're on the edge of discomfort, you know, you might feel some discomfort in your legs, and you go back to your breath, you'll notice you hollow out, you open up. And even though the pain doesn't completely go away, there's a kind of beautiful openness in the midst of that state of being, you know, on the edge of discomfort. You know, all of this is a very deep experience of the body. It's not a gimmick. This is a potential of our bodies. Even enlightenment is a potential of our bodies. You know, so this is a different way of relating to physical existence than Red Book or Cosmopolitan. You know, we're not looking at ourselves from the outside and judging ourselves, our physical appearance, according to some abstract formula. We're experiencing the body by becoming one with the body. And when you follow the breath out, it's like a miracle, right? It takes you out, opens you up, takes you out, and you drop deep. You can sometimes drop deep into samadhi. This absolutely imperturbable place. You know, this imperturbable place. You know, I think people in the modern world, Western people in particular, are very uncomfortable with the body. You know, we have a lot of anxiety about having bodies. I myself, Jaru came last night, and we drove over here and went to the sit, and then on the way home I had to stop at the store. And Jaru said, "What do you need?" And I said, "Oh, just something." So we went into the store, and I went over to the deodorant, right? And I didn't even want to say, "I need deodorant." I didn't want anybody to know that I might smell bad, you know. So I went over and I got some deodorant, and basically deodorant means I want to smell as though I have no body, right? This is all sort of very modern way of thinking about the body. Do you know, in some cultures, people want to get close to you so they can smell you. I had a good friend from North Africa, and he would come right up to my face, and his name is Mohammed Swayeya, and I would say, you know, what, he said, "I'd like to get close enough to smell my friends." You know, it's very different from, you know, modern Western people. But we have an ambivalent attitude towards the body because, why? You know, what's that all about? Part of it's manipulation, you know, you're supposed to be very beautiful in the cosmopolitan sense. But on a deeper level, you know, look, you know, the other day I was looking at a photograph, and I know my hair used to be very black, you know, and now it's gray, and it's falling out. You know, it's getting thinner and thinner. My body is getting older. You know, it's getting older. We, the ideal is that we will be young forever, right? The young person, the beautiful young body, young man, young woman. But, you know, the truth is, you know, if you accept your body, you know, it's going to get old, it's going to get sick, you're going to die, you know. So being one with the body is actually very difficult for people. You know, the physical dimension of meditation is hard because, of course, you have pain in your legs. But it's harder on another level, right? You know, because you come in and you're being one with this thing, you're being one with something that's going to get sick, it's going to get old, it's going to die. And, you know, that's, I think, why people are so nervous around the body. It's uncontrollable, you know. You can't necessarily control certain aspects of your body. You know, you're vulnerable. Having a body makes you vulnerable. I was reading about this guy who actually believes he's going to download his brain, his contents of his brain, onto a computer. And he said, "I will live immortally forever." He really believes this. He's a major figure in artificial intelligence. Now, many people said that's not going to work. You know, you can't do that because your intelligence is coming from your nervous system, which comes from having a body. But you can see why he wants to do that, right? He wants to get away from this body, which is going to get sick, get old, and die. So sitting down on the cushion is difficult for all kinds of reasons. One of the reasons is that it means becoming one with a body, which is uncontrollable, and so on and so on. But, you know, if we become one with our bodies, if we experience the body from the inside out, so to speak, it's this incredible door into the universe and into samadhi and actually into enlightenment, you know. So, enlightenment is really only achievable through the body, actually. So, you know, being one with our bodies on the cushion is difficult for modern people. They would much prefer that we sat in a comfortable chair and maybe introduced ideas that are uplifting and inspiring. This is more modern, right? So, you know, people would come, they'd sit in an auditorium, it would be climate controlled, you'd be very comfortable, and I could give you ideas. Maybe I could tell you about how someday we won't even have bodies and we'll live forever in computers. And that might be very inspiring, but you know, that's all a kind of missed opportunity. You know, when we accept the fact that we have a physical existence, you know, have a body, It's going to get sick. It's going to get old. It's going to get die. It's going to die. And we embrace it. We become one with this thing that's limited, finite, and so on and so on. You know, actually, it opens us up into the world. So, you know, meditation is all about this. It's being one with. Being one with our bodies, with our breath, with the moment, with what's happening around us. And that's so difficult. It's difficult because, you know, this world is a world of like radical impermanence and uncontrollability. It's not just the body. Everything is like this, you know. It's a well-known teaching of Buddhism that everything is impermanent. When they asked Suzuki Roshi, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, his students once said, you know, they once said to him, what is the essence of Buddhism? What is the essence? What is the essence of enlightenment? And Suzuki said, everything changes. Everything changes. You know, so you know, our bodies are here and then they're gone. You know, they get sick, they get old, they're uncontrollable, and then they're gone. You know, and it's hard to deal with. We'd rather think about existing eternally in some timeless realm. But when we become one with the body, you know, sitting on the cushion, sweating on the cushion, working with our pain, it opens the universe up to us, you know. And every moment is like that, you know, actually. You know, to be one with this moment is difficult. It's difficult. You know, and what we usually do, we modern people are very, very future-directed. We're future-directed. You know, so if we're here in a situation we don't like, you know, what we tend to do is to fantasize about a future moment when things will be different. You know, so when we feel trapped or we feel locked in or we feel unhappy, the way we normally respond is to imagine a future moment when we won't be trapped and unhappy, you know? So you know, this is very much the way we think as a culture, you know? So all the time we have a kind of future-oriented mindset. We're always looking for the next moment, which is going to be better. And this is a deeply ingrained mental habit in all of us. It's part of our culture again, right? This future, when we're in the present moment, if we're on the cushion even, you know, you're on the cushion and you're sitting there and you're in pain, you know, you probably think, okay, the bell is going to ring, and then my pain will stop. Okay? And you're right. You know, you could actually count the seconds until you could just keep counting and counting and counting until the bell rings, and then it's over. You can uncross your legs, and the pain stops. Right? And that's sort of how we approach many different things. If we're in a different, you know, this week at work in my job. Things were so tense, you know, because some people in my office are not getting along. One of my people I work with came in to see me, and she was telling me about another woman who works with me. So she said, "Can I come in and see you?" "Yes." And she said, I hate to say this, but so-and-so, you know, has given me a hard time. You know, and they're having a big fight in the office. And of course, this person told me that the other person was responsible. So later in the day, I ran into the other person and I said, "Are you having some conflicts with so and so?" She said, "Oh yes." And so I go in and talk to her, and of course, they both blame each other. And they're really creating a very tense atmosphere. You know, it gets so tense sometimes that I don't necessarily want to go into my office, you know? It's like, oh, brother, this is still going on, right? And, you know, it's possible to say, I can't wait till the day is over. I can't wait till the semester is over. I can't wait till I'm on vacation and I don't have to deal with this. You know, this is very much human nature. You could say that we have a kind of a traveling mindset, we modern people. We're always thinking about moving on to the next thing. And this is very much, especially in America, this is part of our culture, you know? So, you know, when people came to the United States for the first time, they were leaving Europe, and they came and they landed in places like New York City. And, you know, conditions in New York were only so then they move out to the Midwest, and that maybe they didn't like the Midwest, and then they go to California. We all sort of live this way, right? It's like tomorrow will be better than today. You know, I'm going to focus my energies on tomorrow, because today, you know, it's just not working out for me. So we have this, you know, traveling mindset. You know, it's like I'm going to be moving in the direction of the future all the time. And when I'm unhappy, I think about the future. You know, traveling is part of life. That traveling mindset is part of life. Living for the future is part of life. You know, so if you don't like the fact that you are in bad physical shape, you can get a gym card and you can join the gym, and after a year you'll be in better physical shape. That's true. That's part of life. But there's another aspect of life. Traveling is one aspect of life, but another aspect of life is dwelling, being here. See, so traveling is okay. There's nothing wrong with traveling. That's part of life. But there's traveling and there's dwelling. See, and there's a traveling aspect to meditation too. You know, you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and you hope something happens. There's a traveling aspect, but there's this other aspect, which is being here. You know, the moment comes, and the moment goes. And then another moment comes. This is definitely so. This is the traveling aspect. So this koan is called particle after particle of samadhi. If you're sitting on your cushion and you're watching your breath, you know, you watch this breath, and the breath comes, and the breath goes. And the next breath comes, and the next breath goes. And the next breath, and so on, see? Traveling. Everything's constantly changing. So, you know, 3 breaths ago, you were a different person. And in 3 breaths, you'll be a different person again. That's all true. But when you're with this breath, what are you going to do? See, that's the dwelling aspect. There's the traveling aspect, but there's the dwelling aspect. Being here now. This is so important. You know, so important. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, there's an aspect, you watch the breath, this breath, this breath, this breath, but you're always in the same dilemma, right? You're always somewhere. And a part of Zen practice is being here now 100%. 100%. Even if you don't like it. You know. I did not really like going into my office on Friday and having this little civil war in my office. It gets so tiring. And the people involved don't seem to be able to overcome it. You know, I did have my eyes set on 5 o'clock when the day was over and everybody would leave. But on the other hand, you know, the one important lesson of Zazen is that when you're in a difficult situation, instead of imagining a better future, you try to become one with what is happening, even if it's unpleasant. See, so the solution, in a certain sense, is not to try to move forward. Is traveling is not the answer. The answer is dwelling. Be here now. You know. So when you're in a difficult situation, and you become one with what is happening, you know, a strange thing can occur. This even takes place with pain. You know, pain is the hardest thing for humans to deal with. You know. I suppose sickness is the other hard thing to deal with, you know. It's very difficult to become one with your pain or to become one with your sickness. Very difficult. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you want to have a nice sit, and then all of a sudden your hip hurts. You know, and you can't get away from it, right? Now, you know, you can move and you might find your hip still hurts. And you come back to the breath and you come back to the breath, but there's this pain, you know. Now, you know, it's very, very difficult to become one with that moment. But in the middle of that discomfort, you know, this wonder, you can begin to have this great openness. It's like things open up around you. I would just say, you know, being in some discomfort on the cushion is difficult, but if you're in agony, move your legs. But if you don't, if you're not in agony and you just stay with the moment, you try to become one with, you know, you'll begin to feel very different. You begin to feel very open, very flexible, like hollow, right? And open and connected. So it's like the mind gets bigger and bigger if you stay with the moment. You know, you begin to feel more and more connected if you embrace the moment. And, you know, I try to do this in my daily life as well as on the cushion. You know, when we're in a situation that we don't like, you know, if you try to say, okay, this is my life right now. You know, I don't have any other life. You know, when I come into my office and things are not going well and people are fighting, I'll find myself sometimes thinking something like, you know, I wish all of these people were gone and I had a better set of people to work with, you know? Maybe you have friends who aren't getting along and you might think, I wish I had a better class of friends, you know? But you know, actually, these are the only friends you're going to be able to get, maybe in your whole life, but certainly right now. And the people I work with in my office are the only people I can work with right now. You know, these are the people who are here. So you know, it's possible to imagine a better world, but the world I'm in right now is really the only world I could possibly have, you know? We people tend to think, we modern people tend to always think in terms of alternatives, right? Alternatives. So, you know, maybe you don't like your job and you think, I, if only I had made this decision, I'd be in a different job right now. Or if I do this in the future, I'll get out of this job and I'll be in another job. But actually, nothing in your life could be different right now from the way it is. You know, your life is the way it is. Absolutely nothing could be different. I hope I'm not being very clear, but the way things are right now could not possibly be different. It's what it is. It's what it is. And so, you know, we face a choice when we're in this moment of either saying yes or no to the moment. You know, we can be here 20%, 30%, 10%. We can be here almost 0%, meaning we don't want to be here. Or we can just say, okay, this is my life right now. I don't have any other life at my disposal. This is the life I have right now. And I can hate it, or I can embrace it, right? So I'm in an office where people don't get along, or I'm in a family where people don't get along and everybody's unhappy. And I could think, oh, if only I had a better family. If only I deserve a better family than this. I deserve better co-workers than this. You know? But what's happening right now is the only world that could possibly be here now. There's no other world available to me right now than this one. And so, you know, a lot of Zen practice is learning how to say yes to this moment. Is learning how to be 100% connected to this moment. And that's difficult to do, you know, because we might not like it, you know, and we might say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. And as long as you do that, you're going to be unhappy, right? You're going to be, if you, yourself gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And the alternative is to empty yourself out and become one with what's happening. And this is like magic, you know. This samadhi engagement with the moment, deep samadhi engagement, is like magic, you know. Because in a certain sense, you know, we're all like actors in a play, you know. Only, you know, we're like actors in a play. You know, you wake up one morning and you're Hamlet, you know. Don't know if you read Hamlet, but you wake up one morning and you're Hamlet, and you have to be Hamlet. You didn't choose to be Hamlet, but that's who you are, you know. And you can say, I really hate playing this part, I hate being this person, I don't like who I am, my thighs touch. Or you can say, if only I had an IQ of 160 instead of this lousy IQ that I have, right? Or if only I had, whatever you wish you had that you don't, right? But, you know, you woke up one morning and you're Hamlet. And somebody else wrote the script, you know? So you can go through the motions. Good morning, my queen, you know, how are you? You know, you can say your lines, you know, or you can say your lines, right? You can play the part. You're playing a part. It's called Bill. It's called Susan, you know? You didn't write the script, but you can act it out, you know? This is your play. This is your drama. And you can drag along through the script, or you can embrace it, and you can be one with what's happening. You know, and sometimes when we do that, when we just say, I'm going to be 100% present with my life, and I am going to be 100% present with my life, you know, it's like everything unfolds with a kind of a beautiful, kind of like automatically. It's like unfolding on its own, of its own volition. You know, it's like unfolding as it has to unfold. You know, it's like the play. The play goes on, right? And if we play our roles with energy and with openness and a bright mind, it's all quite a wonderful place to be. You know, this world is quite a wonderful place to be. We really don't control it. You know, we really don't control it. You know, who knows what the next moment is going to be? You know, you win the Nobel Prize and you get in your car and you drive down the street and somebody hits you. You know, you can't tell what's going to happen next. This happens all the time, all the time. You know, what was it, last week, this very famous actor, very handsome young man, went for a ride with his friend and he's dead. You know, who would have guessed? You know, so we can't control most aspects of our life. But what we can control is how we inhabit, how we dwell in this moment. You know, we all dream of traveling to a better place, and traveling is a dimension of life. But the other part of life is not traveling, but dwelling. We in the Zen world learn how to dwell in each moment, each breath, 100%. And after a while, there's this sense of being connected to something larger. You know, it's like you're one note, and you're one note, you're honk, you know, toot, 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 toot. And you don't like, I don't like that, that's too high, it's too low, toot, 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 too high, too low. You know, and you can get depressed and so on. But if you just become your note, you know, you're just whatever it is, you know. And you suddenly realize, you know, you're part of like this symphony, right? All around you, suddenly notice there's these other notes, right? And it's all coming together somehow. It's all coming together somehow. And you might say, but I didn't want to be Hamlet. I wanted to be somebody else, you know. That's too bad, you know. It's too bad. If somebody asked me, do you want to be you? You know, that's a difficult question. Probably not. I would have rather be somebody else, right? Maybe many people feel that way. But you know, if you, as long as you feel that way, you're going to be unhappy. It's just a formula for unhappiness. You didn't choose to have size 11 feet. You just do, you know. You can be miserable, you can be happy, you know. But if you become one with, you know, if you say, this is the part I have been assigned to play in this crazy play, I am so-and-so. And I'm going to play this part. I know it's not, I know in a way it's kind of unreal, right? It's kind of unreal. I'm not really Hamlet, you know, ultimately, but I'm going to be present with Hamlet, you know, and be Hamlet for now. And this play is going to, this magnificent play is going to unfold. And this sounds like philosophy, but if you sit down on the cushion and you become one with your breath, you begin to have this deep sense of connectedness. And sometimes there's this tremendous energy or joy that comes from embracing what is happening as it is happening. You know, sometimes you're sitting on the cushion and you think, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. And all of a sudden you think, okay, I embrace it. And then there's this sense of connectedness. It's like you're part of the symphony. And when you feel, when you get out of yourself and you feel connected to the things around you, there's usually like this tremendous sense of joy and freedom. We always think that freedom is going to come in the future, but it doesn't come in the future. It comes in the present by getting outside of ourselves and being part of the bigger drama, the bigger symphony, you know. And that's what we do. We learn how to do that on the cushion. You know, if somebody says, Zen practice, what are you practicing for? You know, we're practicing. Zen itself is life, but we're also practicing for life, right? We're reconditioning ourselves to have a different way of dwelling in the moment. This is about how to dwell in the moment, how to be here now, resentfully, bitterly, fearfully. Oh, those are all possibilities. But you know, it's possible to be here now with this wonderful accepting spirit. And when we become one with, you know, wholeheartedly, it's a beautiful place to be. The world is a beautiful place to be. It's hard sometimes to practice Zen wholeheartedly, you know. You might think, well, you know, I haven't been getting anywhere in my practice. I haven't had Kensho. I've been practicing for 4 years. Where's the enlightenment? You know, that's not wholehearted. You know, when you begin to calculate, you know, I've put in 1,000 hours in Zazen, what have I gotten out of it, you know? I haven't got, you know, at least in martial arts you get a belt, right? You know, you get a black belt. My nephew, when I went to visit, he's only like 11, but he has like, I don't know, a red belt, and he's trying to get his black belt, and oh, wow, a red belt, you know? I said, do you have a blue? No, I don't have a blue belt. That was when I was a baby. Now I have a red belt, you know. So, you know, maybe we should give out belts. But, you know, that's very misleading, you know, because really by doing that, we're just undermining our own freedom, right? Again, giving belts is a big mistake, really. Then you're not practicing wholeheartedly, you're practicing for a belt. You know, I'm practicing for a belt. The beautiful thing about koans is when you finish one koan, guess what your teacher does? He gives you another koan. And never stops, really. See, that's real freedom. So why are you practicing? To become one with. To become one with. Main subject. A monk asked Umong, what is particle after particle's samadhi? Umon said, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. I am, you know, when you're sitting at the table at Sesshin and there's a bowl of rice in front of you and you're not thinking, you're not judging, you're just present with the rice. That is heaven. That is heaven. We have to do a lot of zazen to be present in that way. What is particle after particle samadhi? How are you dwelling? How are you dwelling here now? Umon said, rice is heaven. water.